Thanks to the organizers for the invitation. This workshop has been great so far. I've been here only a week, but I will extrapolate backwards and assume it was great all around. So I will tell you today about something, so some title. So it's two words. So, of path integrals. So the idea is, the question is whether we can make semi-classics exact in the sense that we can do better and better approximations without making, which we can control, okay? Even in semi-classical regimes. So I will only talk about semi-classical regimes where we expect we can do that, but I will try to argue that this is far from complete, okay? I will show you that it's far from complete, and I will give you examples. And the three examples I will discuss is, number one, I will sort of motivating example will be Young-Mills theory.
Excuse me, can you use a little bit larger letters?
Sure. I usually use them too large and too ugly, so. So supersymmetric Young-Mills, and then I will go to quantum mechanics. And also, I will be mostly interested in the Suzy limit. And then the third one will be also, this will be n equal 1, And the third example will be the example of what I call, what we call lovingly the dog, which is n equal 2. Quantum mechanics, which is a very intricate case, which we weren't able to understand for a while, and I've never given a detailed talk about this because I never felt I had the time, so I thought I used this opportunity.
You have to demystify what talk means.
I will demystify. This is a teaser.
You know? It's something like curious.
No. I was thinking about talking about cats and dogs because we also have the cat paper, no time for that. Okay, so the idea of the semi-classics of path integrals is revolving around trying to understand objects like the partition function, let's say, simplest object. And I will always talk about Euclidean time partition function, which is just a thermal partition function. There's a physical interpretation of this, which is just that it's a trace of exponential some beta, which is the inverse temperature times the Hamiltonian. And that can be written as a path integral of some fields and the action of these fields, okay? So it doesn't matter about the details, what the details are. The classical way of thinking about semi-classics of path integrals due to Coleman, Polyakov, Tuft, and so on, is that you first try to solve for the equations of motion of this action, or have some kind of a non-perturbative lump of this field phi, which has an action S0, so it's weighted as e to the s0, Okay? Then you do fluctuations around this lump. So this lump has some kind of a small fluctuations. If you are in a weakly coupled regime, you can do small fluctuations, which you can ignore to first approximation. And you're interested in non-perturbative effects. So I should maybe say also that you first solve the perturbative part, where you set, for example, phi to some classical vacuum, the lowest value for the action, it's usually a constant for this field phi everywhere, and then you do perturbations around that, and that's what we call perturbation theories. It's in all textbooks. But then if you want to go beyond that, you find this lump, and then you do perturbation theory around that lump. But to find the for example, corrections to the ground state energy or something like that, what you would do to first approximation is you would say that there's, okay, so you would write this as a, and by the way, let me also assume that this lump is localized in space and time, so it's an instanton. If it wasn't, if it was elongated, then it would be either particle or some kind of a brain or something like that. I will assume it's an instanton kind of a thing.
There's no space in quantum mechanics.
I'm not talking about quantum mechanics.
It's a function of time, right?
No, but at the moment, I'm not assuming this is quantum mechanics.
Okay?
At the moment, I'm just, this is a d-dimensional quantum field theory, and just giving ideas, because I want to motivate from this perspective. So you take a one instanton partition function, then you have to also do the two instanton and so on. Okay? And to first approximation, at least, the K instanton partition function, you can write as just the... So, one thing that I should say, all of these should be normalized to the vacuum energy, because when you do perturbation theory around the instanton, it's going to be divergent, but it's going to have the same kind of divergence as in the trivial one, and that's just an overall factor in front. So I will also factor out this thing, and that's going to be the finite part. Okay, dot, dot, dot. And then you make an approximation that, to leading order at least, is that n over z0 is something like z1 over z0 to the power of n, and then you divide by n factorial. Okay, to avoid double counting. I should also say what this z1, maybe I write it here, z1 over z0, I can write as an integral, a space-time integral, the dimensional space-time, over some k e to the minus s0, whatever this is. This is some kind of a metric in front of whatever it is. It's going to be flat in this case. And this is the fact that, this is reflecting the fact that translations are, I'm assuming that translations are good symmetries of the theory. So if I have something like this, and if this is constant, I will have something like this. This is spatial volume, and this is beta, this is the temporal, some constant k here. Okay? So if I do this, you see, all I'm assuming is that I have n of these integrals, and I'm integrating over all positions, and then I divide by n factorial, because if I switch to instantons, that's the same configuration, so I want to avoid double counting. And then, now, if I have this formula, then approximately I can write this as a sum over n, 1 over n factorial integral dk e minus s0 to the n. And if I exponentiate this, I get this thing, minus, and I will write it like this. Okay? I will write it in this way. And there's a z-naught here, which I forgot, in front. So the z-naught gives you some perturbative result. And let me write it now for...
So it's not this perturbative action that includes all the loops, right, as well?
No, so S naught is the action, but here K would include all the loops around the. Okay, but I'm ignoring, this is just the first approximation, just the leading approximation I will be interested in, and I will tell you that there is something weird going on if you think about it this way. So now Z naught is, if I take space and time to go to infinity, then Z naught is something like beta V epsilon naught, where this is the perturbative vacuum energy density, and you would have then minus K E minus S naught. So on very general grounds, following this kind of logic, you would have that the vacuum energy is lowered by non-perturbative effects, okay, following this kind of logic.
What was the justification for the factorial formula that Zn was zero?
So this is it's a dilute instanton gas kind of a thing. Okay. So if you buy this thing, then you would conclude that you always have this kind of objects lowering the ground state energy, never increasing. But there are clear problems with that and conflicts with supersymmetric theories, at least naively, and I will try to resolve them. But the resolution is kind of interesting. And to see that there is a conflict with supersymmetric theories, one need look no further than supersymmetric quantum mechanics, where the Hamiltonian is given by something like, and let me put some coupling here, g dx plus I'm going to normalize it like this and immediately factorize it. So that's the Hamiltonian, and I will also normalize it by 1 over g squared here.
Okay, but for non-supersymmetric case, this would be okay. More perturbative effects lower the energy.
Yeah. Well, there's no contradiction. Okay, but that still doesn't explain, if I want to find the theory of semi-classical expansion, which works for everything, I have to then understand how it works for this case.
Okay. Because in this case there is instanton, anti-instanton. Which
of course, of course, I will sort of make contact with this reasoning and then see where the problem lies.
But this was all discussed in the early 80s or late 70s, I believe, right?
It was all discussed. To an extent, and there are elements which are correct. And I will try to sort of emphasize what the picture now is.
I think the thing that is not emphasized is this universal negativity of this contribution.
Oh, it was emphasized. There was a papers by Solomon, by some other.
Excellent, excellent. But it never became very widely appreciated. Maybe among experts it did. But now he will tell you it's actually for any real set of the contribution is always negative.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
But this contradicts some things that we know. So it tells you that you have to go to the space of.
I'll discuss everything.
So could I just miss, why is your constant K positive?
So, of course, it could be negative in principle, but I will give cases in which it's purely positive. And I mean, if you have, so for example, if you don't have positive definite measures, if you have some kind of assigned problem in your fluctuation determinant around fermions would produce an alternating sign. But that's not going to be a problem here. Even though in SUSY you will have this minus 1 to the fermion number, it's actually not a resolution of this thing. It may be naively what you would think is a resolution, but it won't be.
You have the expectation that it's positive.
So, for example, well, you see, if it's a bosonic theory, then this is purely positive, right? So any kind of weight here will be purely positive. Now, I could formulate SUSY theory with fermions, but I don't have to. I can formulate it even like this. This is supersymmetric Hamiltonian. I have two. I just take one. I still have to explain the positive definiteness of the energy in this case, right? Because here, this is a square of the operator's Q dagger. It has to be positive, definite, or zero, okay?
But if you draw the plot of this potential, it immediately explains everything, right?
No.
Yes, because these are two walls which are not degenerate. They are, one is higher.
Yes, but they're still instanton, anti-instanton. What do you do about that? That's still positive definite. And I will explain, okay?
No, but they're connected by fermions.
What fermions? I'm not talking about fermions. I'm not talking about, and that's the thing. I think there's a deep confusion. People just wave it away and they say fermions and, you know. But then you have to explain this one. I didn't formulate it in terms of fermions. I integrated out fermions and I just took one supersymmetric partner, not the other one, okay? So I'll try to sort of explain what's going on here, okay? So I know I said I'm going to talk about Young-Mills first, but since there were so many questions about this, maybe it's instructive to talk about this first. And I already wrote it down. So let's talk about this. If you write this thing down, then you can find the usual kinetic term. Plus the and this will have minus g and there's another g, yeah, okay, so you find something like that, and in the path integral language. And I will now go to a little bit more appropriate normalization of the more appropriate for the purposes I want to give in. In order to match this, I also need to add a 1/2 in front of all of this. Okay, so this is the normalization. And what I will consider is I will consider a case, I will consider just one case, but there's another one which is sort of interesting. And this case will be, so W prime of y is equal to sine of y. And that means that the W of y is minus cosine y. And W double prime is easily computed, also it's cosine y. And if you plot this potential here, you get something like that. So if you now think about this problem and think about this Hamiltonian, it has an exact zero energy solution which can be found from this Hamiltonian, and that solution is just given by e to the minus w prime dx over g squared. Okay?
So there's w prime is w. Hmm? It's w.
Yeah, thanks. So there's an exact zero energy solution. However, this potential here, it has completely degenerate two minima. And there are instantons here. I mean, by instantons, I mean something tunneling from here to here. Okay? Their profiles are going to be kind of different. This is g squared effect, this splitting here. So you can think of it in the g equals zero to limit as an instanton followed by an instanton. Okay? And that would give, by the token I just said, it's a completely real configuration, okay? It's just an instanton. It would give a negative energy, okay? So something else must contribute to cancel that, okay? If we are to believe anything about semi-classics, okay? And the talk will be about the interpretation of this other thing, okay? So if you are going to think of such an event, you can also think of an event now, and this is what we did initially, an event which goes into the complex plane, and there's a turning point here and returns, okay? And then you can just see whether that should be taken into account, okay? It turns out that this event, which goes into the complex plane and back, exactly cancels the first one, and it doesn't have to be positive because now it's a complex number, okay? So let me and this is part of the paper that I wrote with Mithat, we were finding these solutions exactly, okay? But there is a question here. How am I supposed to interpret these things? And there is a theory. I don't know how complete it is, and I get the impression it's not very complete, completely understood, even in the case of finite dimensional integrals, which is called the Picard-Lipschitz theory.
Is it a comment concerning Michel's question? Is that if you go look to a classic textbook, you know, even including your book or Coleman or something like that, what does it tell us to find the saddles? It tells us to invert this potential and solve Newton's equations.
Yes, yes.
And if you do that, there is only one solution. But the reality is not that. That's what people tell us. There is more structure than that.
Okay, I understand this language. It's in a complex plane.
So there are two solutions here, and one is this one, the other one is this one. And Picard-Lipschitz theory is sort of a generalization of ordinary steepest descent integrations in ordinary integrals, which tells us how to sort of do semi-classics in multidimensional integrals. Okay, and the idea of that theory is to generalize the concept of the stationary phase approximation. Now, in ordinary integrals, you usually, if you have an ordinary integral like that, then what you do is you find the saddle points of this thing, and for example, let's say that it goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, and you find the saddle points somewhere. Okay, and then you attach a steepest descent cycle through these saddle points, and let's say that they contribute like this, and then you would say that both of these saddles have to be added, both of these objects have to be added in order to get back your original integration contour. So this is initially what we thought was the case in concerning these things, and we were very surprised that we find complex contributions, because that sort of doesn't happen in quantum mechanics. If this is purely real, there's a theorem. It doesn't happen in ordinary integrals. If this is positive definite, then there's a theorem which says that the something called the upward flow, which is basically what is it called? What is the best name? Dual cycle, okay? Has to intersect your original contour of integration. The problem is that the imaginary part of the action along these dual cycles is constant. And therefore, it cannot intersect the real line if the action is purely real. Okay, so originally we thought that this was a peculiarity of multidimensional integrals, but I will sort of argue that we made a wrong interpretation this first time, and we'll try to explain what is actually going on. Okay.
Then I had a question. If I remember correctly, if you include instantons and anti-instantons, and you do include the interaction between them correctly, you get the correct result.
All of these papers are very ambiguous about this point. Everybody, every paper that I've read is getting the correct result, but here is not a question about the result. We know the result. The question is about building a systematic expansions in semi-classics. And all of them, in some way, go into the complex plane, but they are hiding that under the rug. And I'm trying to disentangle this.
Yeah, but I think it's correct to do this from anti-instantons and into the interactions.
Absolutely. Okay. But you will have a positive definite result unless you go into the complex plane.
How would the interactions change that?
And I will exactly do that now. Now, I should emphasize something.
Brainstorm, there is always a problem whether they become close to each other.
You have to include the interactions.
Include the interactions, okay?
Yeah. I will do that now.
Let me tell you where the intuition fails. Even the notion of there is a separation, genuine separation between instant and anti-instant breaks down. Because separation, quasi-zero mode, is actually part of field space. And this machine tells you that you have to contextify that field space. You can no longer talk about, oh, this is the distance between my instant and instant, if the distance is negative or exponential to pi I over 3.
Mirkat, I will talk about all of these things. I will in fact do that right now. But just before I do that, let me just emphasize one thing. So we've checked that these contributions here, complex contributions, match many tests. Okay, they match the high order growth. They give actually imaginary parts of the Suzy limit, which get cancelled by the trivial perturbation theory according to Resurgent. So it's very compelling to take them in. The question is, how do you interpret these things? Okay, can we have a systematic way of understanding them in terms of Picard-Lipschitz theory or something modified? Okay, or some maybe generalization of that thing. But the curious thing is that we found these configurations. Now, they're configurations you're supposed to integrate over. And if you plot them, they have both real and imaginary part. They look incredibly singular. Okay, they look something like, let me just plot that for you. So since it's going here into the complex plane and back, you would imagine that the real part of y looks something like this. Okay, it goes from the zero, this is y equals zero, and back to y equals zero. But it actually is almost like a step function. It is a step function, basically. And the imaginary part looks something like that. Okay? Now, that's for real coupling. If you continue the coupling just a little bit into the complex plane, which according to Resurgence, you know, you are supposed to do anyway, and perturbative and non-perturbatives cancel when you go around the pole in the Borel plane, they smooth out, okay? And they have their action is smooth in this limit and so on. So it's compelling to take them in, okay? And what I will now tell you is sort of try to build a rationale of why they should be taken in and actually connect with the Picard-Lipschitz theory in a better way. So this is time. And this is the real part. So the solution itself is a function of time. This is real part of y, and this is imaginary.
So that's a finite action solution.
It is. You see, when you have a complexified equations of motion, you would think that singularities would be very bad. But if this is a complex variable, you will have something like x dot squared minus y dot squared for the real part, and there will be compensating singularities here for everything. And remarkably, everything sort of works out quite nicely.
So you should say that in the old literature, a non-smooth solution was impossible, exactly because of this.
Right. Non-smooth solutions were excluded because they have infinite actions and stuff like that. Here, that doesn't seem to be a problem because the action is finite. Okay, but let me now build it in a more traditional way, and it's going to be useful for all other applications because, in general, essentially this is like an instanton anti-instanton. Okay, so what gives? How should I interpret an instanton anti-instanton? And all I can do, what I can do is I can simply superpose an instanton with an anti-instanton, and that's what has been done many, many times in the past, in the 80s, as you say. and they will be at some separation tau. And I can just compute how much their action deviates from the two instanton action. So their action as a function of tau will be a two instanton action plus some interaction. Okay. But in addition, because they are going to be somewhere in this middle well, they're going to, which from here you have g squared over g squared, this part is going to be constant here, and it's going to contribute some constant part, which is, so this is 1 over g, and this will be subleading, and it's going to be something like tau omega, where omega is the natural frequency in one of these wells. It's the same. So now what I can do is I can say, okay, let me now first integrate over all distances of an instanton, anti-instanton, and get a sort of a bion, okay? And then I will resum that bion. Now this object I can consider as an event in time, right? And I will, by using the same principle I outlined at the beginning, just resum that and see what the contribution to the energy is, okay? So if I'm integrating over the interaction is always attractive, number one, and it's always of the form like that, a over g squared, because it's classical, and then I will have, this is plus, sorry, tau omega, okay? Now you can think exactly, if you formulate the theory in terms of fermions, you can think exactly of this interaction, exponential interaction, as a fermion zero mode exchange. And that's useful in field theory applications. And this is a massive fermion, so that's why you have, and the mass is omega, that's why you have exponential decay. So that's the amplitude, okay? But the question is, 2 times S0, the question is how I evaluate this. And immediately there's a problem, because if I go to zero, this is perturbative vacuum, and actually this integral, because this is attractive and this is attractive, completely gets saturated at zero. The other solution, which I was talking about, connecting two vacua here, is actually an instanton-instanton, and the instanton-instanton classically repels. So I call this instanton-anti-instanton. And the instanton-instanton will repel.
Bosonic part will repel.
Bosonic part will repel. The contribution of zero modes will still be the same. Okay? Now you see, this one doesn't really have a problem, because the integral gets saturated. This is repulsive. This is attractive. And if you do everything correctly, you see that it gets saturated around the point, which is log in 1 over g squared. Okay? Where approximation is good, because all I want to do is I want to be probably 1 over omega for dimensional reasons. I just want to be away from 1 over omega, because that's the core of the instanton. So this one is good, and I can compute this, and I can get a result. And by the principles of semiclassics that I outlined, the classical principles of semiclassics of path integrals, I resum them, and I get a negative ground state energy. So this guy must cancel it somehow. But even if I think that this integral is not valid at short distances and I somehow cut it, I still have a problem. It is still positive, and it will still contribute negatively. Okay, this is what I was telling you, Jacques, and you, Misha.
Yeah, but you have to do it correctly. You can't cut it.
But what do you mean, correctly? That's the question. What is correct?
In the right way. I did it a long time ago, but I kind of forgot.
I read your papers, and they're beautiful papers, but okay. This part is not clear.
The complex solution is very nice.
Excuse me, so this is the genus 2 surface, right? So then there are two different imaginary factors.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a partner here, and there's a question which one you take,
right.
Okay? So let me postpone the answer of which one you take for a moment.
Some linear combination of these, or?
I still haven't, actually, in this In this language, I still haven't made contact with that. Let me make contact, and then I will comment on which one you take. Okay? I can give you an answer quickly. You take just one of them. Which one, I will say in a moment. Okay? Okay. So now, in order to... In order to evaluate this, you can now do a sort of a similar reasoning to this and say, well, really my separation is a field space coordinate, and it's the only non-trivial one. The rest of them are sort of Gaussian, and I can treat them by perturbation theory. So let me complexify tau and look for a saddle point here. And if I look for a saddle point in the complex plane, and this was actually done also in the 80s by Balitsky and Jung, there is a saddle here for double well. It was a different system, but it doesn't matter. So you find something here which has an imaginary part of tau omega, let me put them together, at plus psi pi, or at minus I pi. And these are precisely the two solutions here. Okay, they have the same action. You can actually find it just by using this simple formula, which is valid if they're at a large distance, which they are, because this is the, this real part, I should say, the real part of tau omega is proportional to log 1 over g squared, 1 over, yeah. Okay, so it's at a very large distance from the core, and so all the approximations are correct. Okay, so now if you do this integral here, you see, since you're only shifting the integration contour from here to here, you add a plus or minus I pi here, which switches the sign in front, and exactly cancels the first contribution. Okay? And that's very compelling. Furthermore, if you now deform the theory, and this will address the question I had from somebody, which one you take, if I deform the theory and I put a zeta here, just some parameter zeta, when zeta is equal to 1, I get supersymmetric theory, and all perturbation theory is just 0 to all orders. All perturbative connections to the ground state energy are 0. But if it's slightly away from 1, then I have asymptotic growth of perturbation theories, and everything hits me back. Now, the question is which one I take. And what I should do, first of all, even the perturbation theory is not well defined. So what should I should do, because there are poles in the Borel plane on the real axis, so I should take the coupling a little bit into the complex plane. And then that will break the symmetry between these two things, and only one of them should be taken into account. Okay, but there's still a question, why is this even supposed to be taken seriously? Because, as I said, the action here has an imaginary part. And by the Picard-Lipschitz theory, at least what is believed to be the case, I'm still not sure even for finite integrals is there a theorem for that or not, that the intersections of the co-symbols should intersect the original cycle. So I will propose another resolution of this thing which matches with this perfectly.
So why is the action exactly pi I?
So the action is exactly pi I because the imaginary part, you mean.
Yeah.
From this point of view, it's just because when you insert a complex tau, this saddle point is exactly at a, as an imaginary part pi, and it compensates for this. Okay, I don't have a better answer than that. Or if you find the solution exactly, it turns out to be actually, if you make this zeta deformation, it turns out to be I pi zeta. Okay, and that's why it has an imaginary part when I go off the supersymmetric limit, which exactly cancels the imaginary part coming from the Borel resummation of the perturbation series. Okay, so.
So the choice should not depend on, it should be universal choice for when everything is complex, right?
So when you're sitting at the bottom, right, the genus of surface is no longer two, right? Because there's a symphysis. It's like in cyber equipment, you're sitting at the monopole, you know, zero. The curve isn't genus one.
When g equals zero, right?
Well, no, I'm saying that when you're sitting at the bottom of the well, that's a singularity. So the genus is no longer two. So there is indeed a universal choice.
And that we would want that.
Yes.
So now, there's another problem with this interpretation with Picard-Lifshitz theory, if I consider this to be a complex saddle, and that's that in the connection with resurgence here, I'm not really supposed to find a saddle taking quantum effects into account. This is a quantum effect, okay? So could I find another saddle in the G going to zero limit? So it's purely the classical action. Can I minimize it? And naively, there doesn't seem to be any other choice. In the classical limit, I just have these things. Everything is degenerate, and I just have instantons, okay? However, if you put what you should put physically even, if you put a finite time, which is a finite temperature, then everything is periodic, and you can actually find a solution like this. Then your time is a circle, and you have an instanton on this end, and the anti-instanton of this end. Okay? And that's a solution of the equations of motion, but in the terminology of the 80s, it is an unstable solution. Okay? And people, you know, usually try to integrate over this direction. But Picard-Lifshitz theory is not telling us to integrate over this direction. It's actually telling us to integrate over the direction where the action goes up. And now, if you do that, if you now look at the tau plane, so this, by the way, this separation here is minimized at tau equal beta over 2, clearly. Right, because then this attraction compensates this attraction, and you have the same in the limit of g going to zero. Now, if this is the tau plane, and this is beta over 2, if you look, now again, you have to complexify the coupling a little bit, and if you look look at the symbol emanating from this saddle, it's going to go directly into the complex plane, and there are actually in this effective action, there are actually saddles here where the symbol will flow in if the coupling is real. But if the coupling is a little bit complex, it's going to do this. Okay? So you see, this thing is exactly at real part of tau is equal to pi, okay? So now if you take loop effects into account, the thimble is set. It goes through this imaginary tau line at shifted by pi into the complex plane, okay? But the funny thing is that the loop effects also completely suppress this point. Why? Because if I put beta over 2 here into tau and take beta to infinity, that the contribution around this point completely gets killed. Okay? This is very, very different behavior than usual integrals. Yeah, we think that if a saddle contributes, that the most important contribution is near the saddle. Here, it's the tail of the saddle which actually gives all the important effects. Okay? Okay.
To be fair, on the real line, that saddle really leaves at infinity, right?
Yes.
So that is why the contribution, if you want, is coming from the saddle. So over there, you're already on the thimble when you write with tau.
Absolutely. So here you're on the thimble. But the thing is that it's not the thimble of this complex saddle. I mean, you're on the Stokes line, so saddles can go through each other. And I actually think that what happens is that this saddle sort of moves there, okay? But you're not really passing through it if you complexify the coupling a little bit. So the answer is correct, but the interpretation was sort of a little bit misleading. Now, you can ask, okay, this is just one example, that it could be an accident. Well, actually, there are several examples in this class of problems. There's the periodic potential that we checked. There's the double well that we checked. And there's actually a triple well, which we didn't publish yet, which also works remarkably well. But can I then check this thing in some other cases which I know the result of? So let me just see. I have something 45 minutes more, right? Okay, so let me then go to the example number 3 now, because I'm in quantum mechanics and I want to stay in quantum mechanics, where the intricacy of cancellations is nothing short of astounding, at least to me. There is nothing like this happening. There are no two saddles, there are no two contributions, naively, which cancel each other. And this is the case of the dog, so the example I want to consider now as a Euclidean action is this n equal 2 quantum mechanics, as a Euclidean action which I will normalize like this. And I will explain what everything means. Now I have to check not to make a mistake of what the normalizations are. And I think this is a bar in my notation, and this is what, let me just check.
Kaiser fermions,
just I want to make a consistent notation. Okay, it probably doesn't matter, but in my notes, it's just relabeling, but okay, let me keep this notation. Okay, so there are this action is invariant under a supersymmetric transformation. I don't have to write it. I think there are two complex supersymmetric parameters, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, and but what is interesting is that in the case that I take, and I will take in analogy to the last case, I will take that this is z squared minus a squared. I think that's my...
z is complex, or z
actually, for some reason I took 2a squared. Could it be? No. It's correct. This is now, you have to distinguish, this is not complexification of any kind, it's just a way of writing. Everything here is real, and it's a real Lagrangian, it's just a way of writing, and there are two bosons and two fermions corresponding with Suzy. And if you write, so this is just a, you can think of it as a two-dimensional double well, where this is the x-coordinate, and the y-coordinate, at least the bosonic part, right? I'm writing now the bosonic part. And it has sort of the y-direction, which goes this way, sort of curves up, okay?
Excuse me, and then the superpotential z is real. Well, it's just z, not z z bar, of course,
yes, it's right? Holomorphic. Superpotential is holomorphic.
Yeah.
That's
what I mean. So if you write this part... So if you write this part, this is just absolute value of W prime Z squared. Okay, that's the bosonic part. Okay.
Yeah.
So now there's a theorem here that that whatever the number of classical minima here, there, that's the number of zero energy Garam states. Okay, this case doesn't break supersymmetry, and is exactly zero energy solution. One way to see that, and it's actually in your lectures, Misha, the simple way to see that is to just go take the very large limit of very large separation of this A. Then you have harmonic oscillation is a good approximation, and you find that there are two ground states, both of which are bosonic. And since the supersymmetry changes bosonic to fermionic, you cannot lift this pair up in energy, because the higher energies in SUSY all have to be paired up as fermionic and bosonic. But since both are bosonic, you cannot do that. Okay, so corrections all have to be the same.
So for lat A, the weak complex is 2.
Yes, it's 2, exactly. So now there's a question here. I mean, I have the same thing almost like before. I have an instanton here and I have an anti-instanton. I have zero modes, they exchange, I have some weight. I compute everything like before, I don't get a zero result. Here, there is nothing like this real guy who can cancel me. So what in the world is going on? And we spent quite a bit of time trying to understand this. We couldn't really wrap our heads around how this can happen. And Mitkat pointed out to a very interesting exchange in the story of Sherlock Holmes and Silver Blaze, where Inspector Lestrade asks Sherlock Holmes, is there anything to which you wish to divert my attention? Anything more that to which you wish to divert my attention? And he says, to the curious case of a dog in the nighttime. And dog in the nighttime. Uh-huh. And Lestrade says, the dog did nothing in the nighttime. That was the curious incident. The instanton didn't do anything. In that case, it was the dog didn't bark. That means he knew the crook. Okay, the instanton is not barking. It tells us something about semi-classics. Okay, so what is it? And the resolution here is quite intriguing. So, and I want to give it this to you in some detail, because it's nothing short of magical how it resolves. To do that, let me first compute the naive correction and sort of try to understand what is going on. The naive one, which also occurred before, right? If I've spent like 50 minutes convincing you that you should do something in the case of quantum mechanics, N equal 1, SUSY, and even non-supersymmetric cases, I better take into the same principle here, okay? So I can schematically write this thing as an instanton and the anti-instanton, okay, exchanging two zero modes, chi1 and chi2, schematically. I mean, what you can do in practice, you can just compute an instanton, anti-instanton superposition and do a determinant of the fermions around them in perturbatively around their separation. When they're infinitely separated, they become exact zero modes, and they're zero. So they have to be suppressed by the distance, okay? And because there are two of them, they're suppressed as two omega tau, okay? It's essentially everything there is to it compared to the other formula. There are factors in front which you should be careful about, and I will give them to you, and the factors are given in the following way. So the instanton, anti-instanton contribution, and I will put fermion here just to remind us that they are fermion correlated, is 36 omega squared, where omega, sorry, is 2 times A. It's a natural frequency in one of the wells. E to the minus 2 omega tau minus 2s instanton. This is an instanton, and then there's an interaction which is 4 omega cubed over g e minus omega tau. Okay? And then there's the measure of an instanton and the measure of an anti-instanton, including their one-loop determinant, okay? They factorize to this order except for this zero mode. Or quasi-zero modes. Okay.
You already inserted chi1, chi2, right?
Yeah, I integrated them out. So what we did technically is we solved for this determinant, so for these zero modes, okay? And the rest we just factorized into two instanton determinants, the non-zero modes factorized, okay, to this order. Okay? So this is a finite result. And it is a result which is something like, contributes to the energy, something like minus 36 omega squared, minus 2 s naught g squared over 16 omega to the 7th. I think, well, I can cancel omegas here, but it doesn't matter, really. It's something which is negative, in fact. And why is it negative? Because I integrate again over this contour at I pi, and there's a factor 2 here. So the sign is not negative in front of this contribution, and there's a minus sign always when you resum to the energy. And this is the result. So not only is it not zero, it's even negative, which is a big no-no in supersymmetric theories. So something else must contribute, okay? Interestingly, there's another effect here. The zero modes are not... So they can be lifted by perturbations of y, okay? It may not be obvious, but you can think of the instanton as having two parts that factorizes into this matrix you can diagonalize around in instanton, and then small deviations of y can lift zero modes. This is like the Yukawa coupling, and you can sort of connect, absorb the zero modes into the Yukawa, which is coupling to y. You have something like chi1 bar chi2 times y, okay? But this is a higher order in perturbation theory effect. It's very bizarre if this can cancel what, you know, the leading order effect. In this normalization, square root of g here. And so what I want to argue, what I want to tell you is that these zero modes can exchange a Yukawa like this. It can exchange a y fluctuation, y quanta, and absorb the zero modes, okay? But they are suppressed by g because these vertices are square root of g, okay? How in the world can this cancel a leading order contribution? And the answer is quite intriguing, how this happens. So let's write exactly what needs to be taken into account. And I seem to have messed up my notes slightly. Oh, here. Okay. So one thing that you can do is you can first compute a single instanton contribution if you put a small, slowly varying background y. Okay? So then the zero mode, as I said, is lifted, and you can compute its lifting. And the lifting turns out to be, I'm sorry for this mixed notation, but A is 2A's omega and vice versa. So my notes seem to be mixed a bit. You can compute that the leading order, this is the... This is the measure. Okay? So you see the contribution, you have to integrate over t, but this cosh gives you a contribution only around the instanton coordinate. Okay? So this is like a vertex for the instanton. And if you want to now compute a correlation between an instanton and an instanton, which is now, I call it Yukawa correlated, okay? You just square this. You integrate over two t's. Okay, so in order to get the measure for the instanton, anti-instanton Yukawa correlated, I have to integrate over the t and t tilde, and I also have to plug in the correlator for y's. Okay, so at first we just plugged in. Yes, thank you. And bar here, okay? So at first we thought actually perturbative correlator will do just fine because this is mostly perturbative vacuum. You have an instanton and then perturbative vacuum in the middle and then an anti-instanton. And we did it and it didn't work and we were sort of disappointed and we started thinking, okay, maybe this whole thing is wrong. But then we realized that there's actually a subtle difference in the coefficient if you actually take the exact correlator in the instanton, anti-instanton background. Well, not an exact, but an approximation valid at large distance. And if you actually do that, you get the following result.
The question was an II event at the same order of exactly the same type.
How can you have an II? So instanton is going from here to here. Uh-huh. What is another I?
Oh, because you're not doing the periodic one anymore.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that would also be an interesting case. And I suspect that all instantons, anti-instantons get canceled by these kind of things. Okay. I'm not sure what happens to the guys which jump one. Okay? So what you get Nava integrated over TI or let me put it this way, over their separation gives something like I don't have to integrate. At this moment, it's 9g over omega e minus omega tau e minus 2 s naught plus 4 cubed over g mu I d mu I bar. Okay, so you see, there is one difference compared to the previous case. Previous case, I had an exchange of two massive fermions. Here I have only one, but I'm suppressed by G. These two things will conspire to give the same order, okay? So this is less suppressed because it's an exchange of just one massive mode, but it's more suppressed because of higher G, okay? But when you integrate over this thimble that I argued must be done, they cancel magically. Okay.
Now the massive mode that you're exchanging is a boson, right?
Yes. Yes.
How do you get into the minus omega t and not rather?
What would you want? Well, it's the same mass, right?
Yeah, but they should attract one another since you're exchanging a...
In both cases, they attract. In both cases, the propagators are the same. Okay? It's like a tree level more than a loop. You're maybe thinking about the loop should get a minus sign. All the signs are positive here. Okay? So I want to spend a little bit of time. Now, you can do the integral exactly. And with all the factors here, one important maybe point that I want to say. You see, if I'm integrating over the thimble where this omega tau is plus I omega, this actually gets a minus sign, whereas here I had two omega tau, this remains a plus sign. So the signs are different. That's very good, right? But still, the question is, how can they cancel? Because this is G suppressed compared to this one, okay? This has a G suppression. Okay, and how they can suppress is nothing short of astounding. So the reason is that the integrals get saturated at different points. Well, actually, that's not the important reason. They both get saturated at different points, but both are something like log 1 over g. Okay. Now, if you plug in log 1 over g here, this will be 1 over g to the single unit power under the log, which then transforms into a single additional suppression by G in this case. And here it's 2 times, and 2 in front of the log. So in other words, e to the minus 2 times log 1 over g is equal g squared. But here, e to the minus log 1 over g is just g. Okay? So this one gets an extra factor of g to compensate for the extra factor of g here. Okay? And they cancel beautifully. Okay? So, I think this is quite compelling. I agree that this is far from a complete theory of semi-classics, but it's quite a compelling picture. Okay? And there are differences between how we usually think of semi-classics. Okay? I should emphasize that as Jacques pointed out, there are many. This case, actually, there's nothing in the literature even that I've seen that even poses this problem. Okay, the dog. There's things in the literature in N equal one quantum mechanics, but it's interesting how little they even tried to apply it to field theory. Okay. And in the last time that I have, and I think I have plenty of time, so I should be good with time, and maybe even have time for quite a bit of questions, I want to use the same logic in Young-Mills theory, in supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, because this is where I sort of know the results, and I feel confident that something has to be reproduced. So let's try to reproduce it. To do that, I will need a regime which is semi-classical, okay? I could do semi-classics as strong coupling, but there are many things that go wrong there, and it's not very advisable, I think. I think that that approach is a pitfall, and many wrong conclusions can be drawn. So I need a semi-classical regime of supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, where I can compute something, okay? And where I know the result. So a supersymmetric Young-Mills theory is given by the following action. I write it for completeness. And there's a single Weyl fermion here, so that the degrees of freedom match in the adjoint representation. So this is in the adjoint representation here. So d lambda is something like d so I should put sigma mu lambda. Okay? Something like that. Okay? Where these, you can think of these as matrices in the SUN representation. Okay, I'll even make it simpler because I don't want to waste time with unnecessary notation. I will take n equal 2. So, okay, so maybe I should have used curly n here. It's not the same n. But this is n equal 1. super Young-Mills. Okay, so the gauge group is SU2. I can just write it as SU2. Okay, and this theory is strongly coupled, but there's constraints coming from supersymmetry. And one of the interesting observables is the Gluino condensate, which usually in non-supersymmetric theories is not protected by perturbation theory, but in supersymmetric theories, this should be zero in order to be supersymmetric. The reason is that the supersymmetric field strength, this component is not the lowest component, and only lowest component can get a condensate. So Gugino gets a condensate, but this doesn't. Can get a condensate, but this doesn't.
Also happens to be the trace of the energy moment of theory.
Correct. So it's also by the trace anomaly proportional to the ground state energy, and we believe SUSY is not spontaneously broken in this system. So ground state energy should be zero. Hence, this should be zero. Okay, so let's try to see whether in a semi-classical regime of this theory, this holds. And Alexey Cherven already described a semi-classical regime, which is Mithat's favorite regime, and became our favorite regime for many years, Mithat and company, because we can compute things and we feel that, you know, we are not making a mistake. But then we realize that there are some things which we still cannot compute, not because they're not computable, in principle they should be computable, but because we don't have a complete understanding of what semi-classics is. Okay, so the regime is a dimensional reduction. Well, it's not a naive dimensional reduction. It's compactification of the theory to a circle, where you keep fermions periodic in the circle. So supersymmetries are preserved by the boundary conditions, and everything I've said about the condensate, this condensate, still holds there. In fact, the partition function is a Witten index, and it's given by, it's a constant, and it just counts the number of supersymmetric ground states. Okay. So in this, theory, Alexey already told you, but I will remind you, that when you compactify, you get a 3D Young-Mills theory plus, I think there's actually a factor 2 here, but it's not important. A4. And you can think of this compactification as quote-unquote time, but not as temperature, keeping in mind that this kind of thing holds, where this is the time direction. Or you can think of it as space, where fermions are periodic, as they should be. It doesn't really matter, because I'm in Euclidean space, so it doesn't really matter for my purposes. But it is useful to think of it as space, so that I'm still having a 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time. I have some dynamics in the system. So now, what is important is that if there is no phase transition here, we believe that there is confinement at large on R4. Or in a large circle, I should say, so that this trace is zero, and this is an order parameter of some symmetry. In the modern language, it's called one-form symmetry, center symmetry, and it's zero. And a priori, in this theory, we actually don't even have perturbative corrections. So normally, if this is not supersymmetric, there was a famous paper by Gross, Pisarsky, and Jaffe where they computed. Well, it was in the appendix, that wasn't the point of the paper, but I think the paper is mostly known by that, for some reason. And in supersymmetric theory, all of these contributions cancel exactly, and a priori, I can set this to be whatever I want. So I'll set it to be such that this trace of this operator vanishes, and I'll have to justify that at the end of the day. If there are non-perturbative corrections to this thing. So if I do that, then I can take the gauge where this doesn't depend on the fourth coordinate, and let me take it to be also in the third direction. You just make a gauge choice. It's simplest to talk about this in a particular gauge, although this is not, you know, some people think it's a gauge artifact when I do this. I should take that the vacuum expectation value of this V field is such that when I exponentiate this, it vanishes, and I can achieve that if V gets a V which is 2 pi. Okay, then in SU2 case, this trace vanishes.
No, it's pi. It's pi.
No, no, in this normalization, it's 2 pi. Look, I can write it. Okay, so if this is cosine V over 2.
Mikhat is
right. So you know your work very well. That's good. Yes, yeah, you're right. Okay. So it's pi. However, this thing is invariant under shifts of 2 pi, and there are gauge transformations which shift this vacuum. And so this is really an angular variable, which is, or VL, is the same no, 4 pi in this case, right? Because 2 pi is actually a different vacuum. I think that there it's correct. Okay? So
this to use 2 pi unless you use unusual.
No, because you see, okay, let me check just to make sure. So if I take a gauge transformation which is single valued, I have to take this. So I have to 2 pi tau 3, for example. This is single value, do you agree? Right? But this will shift V by V plus 4 pi over L, correct? Because V has, there's an extra factor of 2 here.
But you just get a pi transformation if you shift by 2 pi?
What do you mean?
Coulombic matrix just get flipped, right? From I 0, 0 minus I.
Right, but that's a center symmetry transformation. That's a global transformation.
Yeah.
Then you exchange center vacuum. And this point is invariant under that. Okay. So this is details. It's not very important. What is important is that V is proportional to 1 over L. Okay, and if L is small, then you get a large VEV, and there's a commutator here between AK and A4, which gives a mass to anything which is not proportional in the color to the force component. Okay, so the SU2 theory abelianizes to U1. Okay. And there are actually two fields which are remaining here. One is this V field, so it's a scalar, but it's a compact scalar. Okay, there's some radius of this scalar. And there is...
No, the way you wrote it, because V is a vacuum expectation of A4, right?
Yes.
So why it's complex?
It's not complex. Who said
it? It's complex.
It's compact.
Compact. Compact, that's sort of true.
Yeah. Okay, so my theory is something like that, and I will not write, it's something here, some constant. Okay. So that's my effective theory, but the theory is only U1 at long distances. And there are defects which Alexey Cherman described, which in their core are full SU2, and the core is of the size L, okay? And at very large distance, or larger than the core, this abelian, so this is abelian, no, FKL is proportional to KLR, RS over R squared. Okay? So it looks like a magnetic monopole or monopole instanton at very large distance from the core. Okay? That means that the theory must involve these monopole instantons because they have a finite action. They're regulated by this core here. And in fact, they have a core proportional to this V, vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. That's the same as in Georgi-Glashow model. So the monopole, and I will call it M1, it will become clear why, is proportional to 1 over g squared, and on dimensional grounds it has to be proportional to L times V, okay? However, I said that this V is a circle, okay? This V is a circle, or L times V is a circle, and if I have some VEV, so this is 0, let's say, and this is L times V vacuum expectation value. So I just found the monopole which has this action here. So at the core, I go to 0. But at the core, I can go to 0 this way as well. So I will have two monopoles, which have complementary, like 4 pi minus LV over G squared. Okay? Sorry for the mess. My use of board is deteriorating with time. Okay. So let me write the conclusion a little bit nicer. There are two monopoles. And their contribution, so let me write it like this, is, I'll write it a little bit more precise. And monopole 2. So if you do everything correctly, you should get this. Okay. So probably, actually, I'm wrong with the periodicity of VL, but I don't know how to correct it now.
The same in the symmetric, center symmetric point?
At the center symmetric point, yes, but I want to consider the coupling to this. So probably I made a mistake with this periodicity, and I can't fix it right now. So probably you're right that it's 2 pi. It's not an essential thing, so let me write the 4 here. I know what I'm supposed to get, so I'm cheating a little bit. I'm sorry about that. And there should be 2 pi here, probably. So in any case, at the center symmetric point, there should both be, if you plug in V times L is equal to pi, you get e to the minus 4 pi squared over g squared, and here you get e to the minus 4 pi squared over g squared, which is exactly half the instanton. Okay? Well, I cheated here, but okay. You'll forgive me.
Okay, factors of 2 always disappear on the blackboard.
Yes, exactly. So, but the coupling I want to keep to this V, because V is a field, okay? V is a field, and I somehow have to argue that it gets a VEV at the center symmetric point, okay? So now, if I...
you want to put fermion zero modes?
Yes. So that's what I'm going to do next, okay? So this was all using just bosonic part, and so this was at the center symmetric point. And at if I consider a theory with fermions, which supersymmetric theory is, these objects actually have zero modes, and these were discussed by Mithat and company a lot. And the way to take them into account into these monopole operators was discovered by Tuft, and it's called as a Tuft vertex. Okay, so this is just telling you that this contribution doesn't contribute to any observable unless you have a fermionic source. Okay, so if you have a fermionic source, then you can contract fermions and you'll get a contribution. If you don't, then this object just vanishes. Hasn't contributed. So, by the way, this incidentally, this is why the Gugino condensates formed, and these objects give a contribution to the Gugino condensate. Okay, but what about the contribution to this V field, or furthermore, what about the contribution?
By the way, for what? New, but for what? Gugino is has two values. It's plus or minus in this,
right.
Because there are. How is reflected? Is it plus minus in front of the vertex, or there is some I, or what?
No, there is a. Okay, that's a very good question. There is a coupling to the dual photon, which is complex,
yeah.
And the dual photon gets a VEV, and I think this is exactly how you get vacua. The two vacua, you have a cosine 2 sigma. Sigma is a dual photon.
Yeah.
And it takes a value at 0 or pi. And there's a coupling here, which I didn't write.
Okay.
But that's how you get the two values. But I don't want to focus on that. So now, there are also objects which are just barred versions of this thing. And... off these things. And what I didn't write, as I mentioned now, is that there's also some coupling to some scalar field, which all, for my purposes, all the scalar field is supposed to do is account for the monopole interactions between these, because these carry sort of like a quote-unquote monopole charges, and they are attractive. Between this guy and this guy, so you can think of that as having some opposite charges, and if I integrate over this field, there's a systematic way how to derive this, but if I integrate over it, then I will get attraction from these sigmas. Non-trivially, maybe, if you integrate over this V field, and if you take into account all the factors correctly in front of the kinetic term of V, then these two don't interact classically at tree level at all. This reflects the fact that they are BPS solutions, okay? But this is one check that all factors are correct, which they probably are not here anyway, so. So here I also have these things. But the objects which will contribute to the potential for V and potential for sigma will be objects where I can contract zero modes. And what Mithat did, it was under in his paper, New Mechanism of Confinement, was to contract these two guys. And you see, they will attract here, and they will actually attract also here, because there's a plus sign here. And there's a minus sign here, and there's no I. So it will be the same sign of the attraction here. I meant repel, okay? This is very important. They will repel by their bosonic exchange, but they will attract by their fermionic exchange. And if you write everything down, you will get something like the integral over the distance between these two objects, e to the minus 1 over Coulomb, repulsion, and r to the power of 4, 1 over r squared will be 1 fermion in 3D, 1 over r to the 4 will be 2 fermion, because I have 2 here, I have 2 here, so I get this thing. And Mithat said, well, I can compute this because this is repulsive, this is attractive, actually the integral gets saturated, very far from the origin, everything is peachy dandy, and you get a result. You have some, also they couple as 2 times sigma, because here's a sigma, here's a sigma.
Where is the coupling constant? g squared.
It's so it's in lambda. Okay, I hid it here in lambda.
How is green a field as I see it?
No,
those
are lambda g squared.
Yeah.
So sorry, where's I didn't write lambda here. I think lambda is something like g.
Lambda, your notation is the green a field. Look at.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. Let me use something else. What do you want for coupling? G squared. It's actually, I think, 4 pi. Okay, if you're forcing me, I think this is the correct thing. Since I'm good up to factors of 2 anyway, this is the correct thing. Okay, so this is the coupling at that length scale, 4-dimensional coupling at length scale L. Okay, so I can do this integral and I get some result. And now let me call it integral 1. Okay. But there's another integral. By the way, notice also that the V cancels here, okay, from these two guys, because they come with an opposite sign when I multiply these things out.
But it doesn't couple to holonomy.
It doesn't couple to holonomy. It couples actually to derivatives, but not to the potential for holonomy. The other guy is, so this is M1, M2 bar.
Tau to the 4?
Tau?
So
it's two zero mode exchanges. So a propagator, lambda x, lambda bar y, is 1 over x minus y squared, okay, in 3 dimensions. Okay, so here for M1, M1 bar, so these are these two, sorry, these two. I will cancel the magnetic charges, but there will be a coupling to this holonomy, okay? And I will have a plus, though, here now. Again, over R to the 4. And I will have some coupling of the form, what was it?
Minus 8 pi by g squared.
8 pi g squared VL minus. Yes, but there's also, okay, 2 times. Okay, 1. Okay.
Where is sigma? Sigma is scalar.
So actually, it would be beneficial to write this as some V tilde L. Plus pi, and here this is. Let me just see. I want to expand this. So V L is equal pi plus V tilde L, and here. Oh, so this would be pi minus V tilde L. Okay? So if I. Right? Did I screwed something up? In any case, this should be something like pi minus V L tilde, yes. Okay? So it is something that couples like that here, and if I take the other pair like this, I will get e to the, I'm sorry, no, the rest. What I'm trying to say is that I want a vacuum is at V tilde 0, okay? So if you rescale properly, you'll get, let me write it.
Excuse me, Tim, it's now 10 minutes past 12. Can you somehow meet intermediate stages, because.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, I mean, yeah. Let me tell the punchline, okay? So the point is that these two integrals, so this one is properly, it can be computed nicely, but this one is saturated at R equals 0, okay? And now, if you look for complex saddles in R, you find that they are at the negative R, and they are somewhere here, okay? So if you do the first integral on this line and the second integral on this line, they exactly cancel, okay? Now, I don't have a nice interpretation for what these configurations are. I don't know what negative separation is. But I think philosophically, it's a correct thing, a way to think about. It's a field direction, okay? And there are some configurations where you can think of this separation as being negative, okay? And it gives the correct result. And furthermore, it gives the correct result that I don't have time to, I was going to show this to you, but I got confused about factors. So when you exponentiate this, and if you didn't take into account this negative sign, you would actually get stabilization of center symmetry, which would violate Witten index, which would violate that there's no phase transition here, the center symmetry phase transition, and all hell will break loose. Also, f mu nu squared can now be understood as being zero because there are contributions of these bions which add positively. They carry f mu nu squared. There are contributions of these bions which carry negative f mu nu squares, and they exactly cancel. Okay, so here I will stop. I for some reason thought that I have more time. I think I miscalculated something. Sorry about that. Any questions at this point, or did I confuse everybody with the last part?
I mean, you consider totally M1, M2 bar, M1, M1 bar, and for M2, M2 bar, it will be the same. Right?
Yeah, actually, both you need, because, so, very roughly, so M1 bar will contribute something like that, and the M2 bar will contribute something like that, okay? And these combine into cosh of V bar L, okay? V bar is shifted to center symmetric point. But you see, the sign here is very crucial. If I sum them up just naively with a positive sign, which is what I would think this gives, I would get a minus sign, and this would be destabilizing the center. So this is not the correct vacuum. But the thing is that I'm not supposed to evaluate this on the real line. I'm supposed to evaluate it on the negative. There's another interesting thing is that since I was talking about quantum mechanics, that you should regulate it in a box, it would also be nice to find a saddle on finite volume, which is two instantons at opposing sides, without taking into account perturbative effects, and then find the thimble corresponding to this unstable saddle. This would be the proper way of doing it, okay? So far, I've just said, oh, there's some kind of a complex point in this quasi-zero mode integral, but I haven't really convincingly, I think, argued that this is the right integral to do, except for the fact that you must do it, I mean, unless you buy that thing. But it's not very rigorous, okay?
If you include the vacuum angle theta, do you get the right answer?
Absolutely.
Well, it vanishes, of course.
It vanishes.
You cannot ask. Yeah,
but you can break supersymmetry softly. You can break supersymmetry softly, yeah. And everything comes out to be exactly as you expect on our floor.
I see.
Right. Yes. Sergei wanted to ask something.
Well, I was wondering, if you do this in gauge theory, then different configurations are stabilized by different gauge groups. So the volume of the gauge group obviously appears, and that changes, actually that affects transserious coefficients in a dramatic way. So did you take into account this?
So can you say again, what is the...
Well, in gauge theory, the volume of the gauge group affects or enters computation of transserious coefficients, and that sometimes can make it vanish simply because relative volume of gauge symmetry stabilizing different configurations may be infinite.
Well, in this regime, that doesn't enter, because if you're thinking about orientations, for example, of instantons, these are actually all covered by the zero modes of these fractional instantons. So the in SU2, an instanton has 8 moduli,
yeah.
And here you have a relative distance between the two. So you have 3 moduli of 1, fractional object. You have three moduli of another one, and then there are two angular moduli, which are just very simple. They don't have any interesting moduli space. I mean, if they are very close, then maybe they will have some moduli space, which is non-trivial. But you see, everything I did is at very large distances, and this is very important. I mean, of course, there will be contributions which overlap, but these are actually measure zero compared to everything else. When you, when you're integrating over everything, this is just a correction when they exactly overlap. And it's a next to leading correction in everything that I said. So
something like something else, even if they're widely separated, they break actually gauge symmetry. But for example, if you can compare this to contribution of what you used to call Z0, which has no instantons, then that doesn't break gauge symmetry, and the relative factor is infinite, and that enters intron-series coefficients.
Okay, so you're comparing the trivial vacuum to this, but the trivial vacuum here is not very interesting. It's zero to all orders because of Suzy. So indeed, I mean, this you may have to take into account by... But here you see the contributions which cancel are almost completely symmetric. The only thing which is different is their interaction, but in a non-trivial way. So one connects to the vacuum, to the pure vacuum, and that's very bad, right? So you have a interpolating quasi-moduli which connects to the pure vacuum.
Right?
So then when you complexify, and at least... Look, this is far from rigorous, I agree completely, but it's, I think, compelling.
I think just to summarize the story about these correlated two events is that the crucial thing is that there is a relative phase between these two type of events. And it is, we call this sometimes hidden topological angles, so sort of coming from the cycle that you are doing the integration. And that phase is very crucial for the stability of the center symmetry, for the existence of two aqua. And when you are calculating something like gluon condensate, it is also extremely crucial, just like it was in quantum mechanics, for the cancellation of the contribution for these two events to the gluon condensate. In the old QCD literature, this is a very confusing issue, because you have a QCD-like theory with a positive definite fermionic determinant. The fermionic determinant is real here because it's a real representation. And it is still sort of puzzling to me how this quantity, which is supposed to be positive definite, comes out to be zero. But at least in the semi-classical domain, Semi-classics assumes that there is a supersymmetric regularization. All of its structure, All of its effective theory is manifestly supersymmetric. They tell you that when you do that, when there is such a construction, the gluon condensate, vanishes because of these hidden topological angles. So that's sort of bigger story,
Actually, I have similar questions because I have trouble transmitting this mathematically into really the language of what I'm playing trans series. Can we take that dog and walk it to whatever plane and see whether it bites them or what does it work?
In my opinion, the most, the greatest obstruction to this is, to all of these checks, is that we simply do not have access to perturbative series,
you actually don't know that the structure.
No, we don't. I mean, the thing is, this is supersymmetric, so perturbation theory vanishes, but it's also not interesting from the point of view of resurgence. You have to actually, this is sometimes we call it Cheshire cat resurgence, that's why I wanted to call it cats and dogs, because when you break supersymmetry a little bit, and in quantum mechanics we can see that explicitly, everything hits you back in the face. So the relations are there, it's just that it's 0 plus 0 is 0 in the supersymmetric limit. But if you just go a little bit off, everything comes back. In quantum field theory...
I think you are not quite right here. Because what you showed, F minus squared vanishes, right? But if you draw the standard diagrams, which give you, normally give renormalons, You have to show, because f mu is exactly zero, there should be no contribution from renormal ones to conspire with it.
I didn't say renormal ones.
I say renormal.
Yeah, you say renormal. Okay?
I say. Because normally all these condensates, when they're non-zero, they have to conspire with renormal ones to present altogether a well-defined result, right? Mm-hmm. We know it from other examples. Here, if you draw a standard graph, just the graph which all people use to draw a non-supersymmetric case, you see a normal one. Okay? But there is no way when you square to conspire with.
Ah, I understand.
It's clear that this bubble should be somehow in a different types of graph.
Perhaps I'm biased, but I'm very careful about staying away from renormal ones for precisely that reason, okay? So, from the terminology, okay, in connection with resurgent reconciliation, you see, renormal ones here, bubble diagrams here, are not problematic in this regime at all. The reason why they're not problematic is because the renormal one singularity of the bubble diagrams occurs because when you integrate all the way to zero in the momentum, you get trouble. Here, when you integrate to zero at the scale L, everything becomes abelian.
Well, this of course okay? Trivial. No, I mean this on R4.
Right.
At weak coupling, there are no renormal ones because all these gauge bosons are heavy.
Right.
Exactly.
I did not talk about extrapolating this to strong coupling. My philosophy is that if you take into account everything semi-classically in this theory and extrapolate to a large circle, everything should be smooth. However, my point of this talk is that we don't even know how to do that properly. Using path integrals, maybe using differential equations, we are sort of more confident, much more confident. Mathematicians have more results and we can compute things more precisely. Here we really don't have, if all we knew about quantum mechanics is path integral formulation, we still wouldn't know what high order perturbation theories are. Unless, you know, some miracle happens or something like that. Because Feynman diagrams are incredibly inefficient at computing high orders.
No, but the best example is, like you said, supersymmetry. There is no perturbation theory.
I agree.
What better can you...
I agree, but we still... But in order to go to strong coupling, I have to resum non-perturbative things to all orders. Now, in supersymmetric theories, I can use supersymmetry to help me out. But even then, you know, if I go to strong coupling, I'm sort of confused.
Don't explain me that it's very hard.
I thought maybe you forgot, but